News.
Today is Friday, December 17th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, NATO chief accuses Russia of increasing its military presence on the Ukrainian border.
We discussed Russia's substantial military buildup in and around Ukraine with tens of thousands of combat-ready troops, tanks, artillery.
Plus, U.S. Congress approves import ban targeting forced labor in China.
The Senate has given final approval to a bill barring all imports from China's Xinjiang region unless businesses can prove they were produced without forced labor.
Also, human rights groups accuses forces from Ethiopia's Amhara region of atrocities in the Tigray region. Our top story today is in Russia. Russia has published draft security pacts demanding that Ukraine and other ex-Soviet countries be barred from joining NATO and that restrictions on troops and weapons in Europe be put in place. The document has been submitted to the U.S. and its allies. Russia is demanding a ban on NATO military deployments in the former Soviet states and allied countries which joined NATO after 1997, after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Friday's publication of the draft pacts come amid soaring tensions over a Russian troop buildup near Ukraine that has created fears of an invasion. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybakov said Russia's relations with the U.S. and its NATO allies have reached a, quote, dangerous point, unquote. The draft contains obligations to pull back weapons and refrain from drills near the border between Russia and the alliance members. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said on Thursday Russia was increasing, not reducing, its military presence on the Ukrainian border. Stoltenberg said there were Russian troops, tanks, and artillery on the border. The Kremlin denies any plan to invade Ukraine and says it has legitimate security interests in the region. Stoltenberg said the alliance stood ready for talks with Moscow, but would, quote, never compromise on the rights of every single sovereign nation as Ukraine to choose its own path, unquote.
We discussed Russia's substantial military buildup in and around Ukraine with tens of thousands of combat-ready troops, tanks, artillery, armored units, drones, electronic warfare systems. We see no sign that this buildup is stopping or slowing down. On the contrary, it continues. We also send a very clear message that we are ready to talk to Russia. We actually believe in dialogue. We believe that dialogue is important, especially when times are difficult as they are now. And our invitation to Moscow to meet in the NATO-Russia Council stands, and we are ready to sit down. But we will never compromise on the right of every sovereign nation as Ukraine to choose its own path and of the principle that it is for Ukraine and the 30 allies to decide when Ukraine is ready to join the alliance.
That's NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. Congress has approved an import ban targeting forced labor in China while the Biden administration is imposing sanctions on Beijing over abuse of Uyghurs. China's government has condemned the sanctions and said it would respond to them in unspecified ways. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
The Senate has given final approval to a bill barring all imports from China's Xinjiang region unless businesses can prove they were produced without forced labor. Senator Marco Rubio.
It basically says that you can't import products into the United States that are made by slave labor.
He adds,
it's already illegal, by the way, to bring goods made with slave labor. It's been that way since the 1930s. And yet it's still happening.
Rubio says many companies have already taken steps to ensure their supply chains do not include products made by the forced labor of China's Uyghur population. And those who haven't will no longer be able to make Americans
unwitting accomplices in the atrocities and the genocide that's being committed by the Chinese Communist Party.
Meanwhile, the Commerce Department levied new sanctions targeting Chinese biotech and surveillance companies, a leading drone manufacturer, and government entities for their actions in Xinjiang. Ben Thomas, Washington.
In Hong Kong, students and teachers have been seeing a change in the classrooms this school year as part of the national security law implemented by Beijing. Some, as the two teachers in this story, are expressing concern and anxiety. VOA's Elizabeth Lee reports on changes inside Hong Kong classrooms.
On the surface, Hong Kong is still the bustling metropolis of Asia, but changes within school walls are causing anxiety among many veteran teachers. Adrian is a teacher who asked that we use just his first name out of concern he may face consequences for stating his opinion. Adrian teaches liberal studies classes that aim to develop critical thinking. The name of the course changed to Citizenship and Social Development after the 2020 implementation of Beijing's national security law.
In the past, we can very freely make comments on different policies and invite students to give their opinions on those policies. But now we are afraid that some criticism on the policies may be accused of endangering national security or inciting hatred towards the government. So we do have worries, and so do the students.
Hong Kong's education secretary defends national security education in primary and secondary schools. In a statement carried by China's state-run Xinhua news agency, the secretary said the curriculum gives students a clearer understanding of the inseparable relationship between the country and Hong Kong, the one country, two systems governance model, and the law's role in Hong Kong's prosperity and development. Karen, a Chinese studies teacher, also asked that VOA use only her first name, fearing consequences for speaking out. Karen says even though she's attended workshops on new teaching guidelines, she still is not sure what might get her into trouble. Adrian says some of his colleagues have quit teaching and moved abroad. He says students who are not affluent or from mainland China are still in Hong Kong, while many wealthier families are considering a move abroad. And this is happening not just in secondary schools. Juliana Yu heads a company that helps Hong Kong students apply to schools overseas.
But now we see a trend that students are much younger. Some of them are considering going abroad when they're in primary schools because they can relocate with the family.
A survey by the Hong Kong Federation of Education Workers found 90% of kindergartens have fewer students this school year. The reasons include the pandemic, immigration, and a drop in the birth rate. Some parents at this immigration fair want their children to leave, but it's tough for 21-year-old Ken Chan.
Since I was born and raised in Hong Kong for over 20 years, and all my close friends are here, all of these are my concerns.
Again, secondary school teacher Adrian.
There's still some space for me to deliver some message, that some values to the young generation. So I'm eager to stay for some more years so that I can do something for Hong Kong.
A desire Adrian hopes younger teachers will keep in mind as they decide whether to stay or leave Hong Kong. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
As the coronavirus pandemic continues its deadly sweep around the globe, health officials are racing to get as many vaccines into arms as possible. In this report on COVID vaccines, VOA's Carol Pearson looks at those made in China.
Sinovac and Sinopharm are the leading vaccine manufacturers in China, and each has produced vaccines that have been approved by the World Health Organization for use against COVID-19. Sinovac is a privately owned company, while Sinopharm is government-run. Chinese scientists use the same method to make both vaccines. Dr. Andrea Cox is a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. She says for vaccines like these, scientists take a virus or bacterium, inactivate or kill it, and inject it into people. Because the virus is dead, it can't infect anyone. Then, if a vaccinated person is exposed to the live virus, their body recognizes it and launches an attack to fight it off. But Cox says there's a downside.
The problem is that these inactivated vaccines are eliciting a different and a slightly, on average, less effective type of immune response. The Sinovac vaccine has been tested and been shown to be variably protective, but not quite as effective as some others out there.
The World Health Organization says the Sinovac vaccine is about 50% effective, but there are other important factors in making and distributing a vaccine. Sinovac says the vaccine significantly reduces the severity of a COVID-19 infection. The WHO reported Sinopharm at 78% effective. Two doses are needed for both vaccines. To make them even more effective, vaccines are often mixed with an adjuvant, a harmless ingredient like aluminum salts or a bubble of fat. On its website, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says aluminum is one of the most common metals found in nature and is present in food, air, and water. So it's not a foreign or dangerous ingredient, although anti-vax groups claim it is. For example, Sinovac uses aluminum hydroxide, an ingredient also used to treat an upset stomach. The Sinovac and Sinopharm vaccines have a major advantage over some other COVID vaccines. They're easy to store and only need normal refrigeration. Until more effective vaccines are available, that's a huge plus in getting a COVID vaccine to people in remote areas. Again, Dr. Cox.
In an ideal world, we wouldn't need them, but at this point, we need a way to get the world vaccinated as rapidly and effectively as possible, and it may require use of vaccines that we know are not as good, but are better than not being vaccinated.
The World Health Organization says safe and effective vaccines are a game-changing tool, but for now, and for the foreseeable future, the WHO recommends continued mask wearing, frequent hand cleaning, good ventilation indoors, practicing physical distancing, and avoiding crowds, and, above all, getting vaccinated against COVID-19 when you can with whatever vaccine is available. Cox says we're lucky to have so many governments investing in the vaccines and so many top scientists working on making them.
Having the world's best scientists, and I do really mean the world's best scientists, thinking about how to make effective vaccines and deliver them to a global population is critical. And the more data we get on these vaccines, the more we will be able to select out vaccines that do protect the largest number of the world's population.
The WHO says it's not vaccines that will stop the pandemic. It's vaccination. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Civil rights groups Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch says forces from Ethiopia's Amhara region have committed a series of atrocities in the neighboring Tigray region. Gilmore Dawit reports from Addis Ababa.
According to the two groups' reports released Thursday, Amhara region militia forces are carrying out mass detentions and killing civilians in western Tigray. Jean Mariner, director of crisis response at Amnesty International, says the new onslaught of abuses by Amhara forces against Tigrayan civilians remaining in several towns in western Tigray should ring alarm bells. Mariner also called on immediate intervention to prevent further atrocities on ethnic Tigrayans in detention facilities. The rights groups say they learned of the atrocities from victims, witnesses, and residents of western Tigray. The rights groups say Amhara region police officers, police militias, and a civilian militia group known as FANOS have systematically rounded up Tigrayans in towns of Adebay, Humera, and Rawayan since early November. According to the report, the Amhara forces are also involved in looting shops and villages. Witnesses say the forces also shoot locals when they attempt to flee. Both rights groups called on the Ethiopian government and its allies to stop targeting civilians, release the detainees, and allow humanitarian agencies access to western Tigray. They asked the international community to put pressure on the government and pave the way for international investigation. Amnesty International says it has sought a comment from Ethiopian authorities on the matter, but got no response. Western Tigray is a disputed area between Tigray and Amhara regions. Amhara forces entered this fertile area following the outbreak of hostilities between the federal government and the Tigray forces in November 2020. On Friday, the United Nations Human Rights Council will hold a special session on the situation in the northern Ethiopia following the request by the EU. But Ethiopia objected the move and said the decision is politically motivated. Gilmore Dawit for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
The UN's main human rights body opened a special session Friday to discuss rights violations in conflict-torn Ethiopia. The forum will consider a draft resolution brought by the European Union that condemns violations committed by all sides, and if adopted, it will set up an international commission on human rights experts on Ethiopia to investigate further and report back after a year. Ethiopian ambassador Zenebe Kebede rejected the resolution and said it would not cooperate with any such commission. The likely virtual one-day session of the Human Rights Council seeks to ratchet up international attention on a conflict that has left tens of thousands dead since fighting erupted 13 months ago between government forces and fighters from the Tigray region. Dozens of young men and women say they have left jobs in the city to become guerrilla fighters in the jungles of Myanmar. The new recruits learn how to load rifles and set detonators for homemade bombs as they prepare to battle the army behind the February 1st coup. Duruf Tikenka, Reuters, reports.
Gunshots ring out at this makeshift shooting range deep in the forests of Myanmar. These civilians are learning how to fire live weapons as they prepare to battle a sizable, trained fighting force, Myanmar's own military. The junta staged a coup in February this year, ousting the civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi from power. Hundreds of resistance groups have since popped up across the country. Reuters managed to get rare footage of these young men and women, some former protesters who traded in their urban attire for jungle camouflage. And their numbers look to be growing, according to one former student activist turned fighter. Seclusion, however, has come with its challenges. Mud pots, waterways, and days of trekking have made access to food a problem. But the rebels still persist. That fight may continue to weigh heavily on the resistance, as close to 1,300 civilians have been killed and more than 10,000 arrested since the coup.
That's Duruf Tikenka of Reuters. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Conservative Party has suffered a surprise poll defeat that was a referendum on his government amid weeks of scandal and soaring COVID-19 infections. AP correspondent Charles Della Desma reports.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Conservative Party has suffered a stunning poll defeat that was a referendum on his government amid weeks of scandal and soaring COVID-19 infections. Helen Morgan, from the opposition party, the Liberal Democrats, overturned a Conservative majority of almost 23,000 votes from the last election to win Thursday's contest in North Shropshire, a rural area of northwest England. The election was called after the former Conservative Member of Parliament there resigned amid a corruption scandal. Against this backdrop, opponents, as well as supporters, are questioning Johnson's handling of the pandemic after coronavirus. Virus infections soared to records this week as the highly transmissible Omicron variant swept through the country. Charles de Ledesma, London.
This is the Voice of America. More than 20 people are feared dead after a fire broke out in a building in Osaka in western Japan, and police are investigating arson as a possible cause. The fire started on the fourth floor of an eight-story building in the major business, shopping and entertainment area. A fire official says 27 people were found in a state of cardiac arrest, and one other woman was injured. She was brought down by a ladder from a window on the sixth floor. The value of Afghanistan's currency is tumbling, exacerbating an already severe economic crisis in the wake of the Taliban takeover and deepening poverty in a country where more than half the population already doesn't have enough to eat. The Afghani lost more than 11% of its value against US dollar in one day earlier this week before recovering somewhat. The economy was already troubled when the international community froze billions of dollars worth of Afghanistan's assets abroad and stopped all international funding to the country after the Taliban seized power in mid-August. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. An Australian-led study warns that 1,500 of the world's 7,000 recognized languages might no longer be spoken by the end of this century. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The research published Friday in the journal Nature, Ecology and Evolution details a wide range of factors putting endangered languages under pressure. Australian researchers have found that as roads increasingly connect cities to more remote areas around the world, indigenous languages can be overwhelmed by their more dominant counterparts, such as English. The study also asserts that bilingual education has been neglected. Again, dominant languages have been found to smother those spoken by smaller groups. Experts have said Australia's record is poor, and the country has one of the world's highest rates of language loss worldwide. Before European colonisation, more than 250 First Nation languages were spoken in Australia. Today there are just 40, and only a dozen are being taught to children. Professor Felicity Meekins is from the University of Queensland and one of the study's co-authors.
This has been an ongoing process through colonisation and globalisation. So we don't want to forget, of course, in all of this that individual speech communities have their own histories and experiences. And in many places, including Australia, languages have been silenced as the result of brutal colonial policies which have been designed to suppress languages. So, for instance, in Australia, people were punished for speaking their language. And these experiences were really traumatic and have had lasting consequences for the ability of language communities to pass on their languages.
Researchers have said that as the world prepares for the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, Decade of Indigenous Language in 2022, their findings were a vital reminder that more action is needed to save at-risk languages. They've said that every language is brilliant in its own way and a critical part of our human cultural diversity. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
NASA touches the sun and looks to the future by travelling back through them. Plus, Japanese tourist visits the ISS and a space travel pioneer's daughter follows in her father's flying footsteps. VOA's Arasha Rabasadi brings us the week in space.
NASA launched Parker Solar Probe.
This week starts with big news from NASA, which says its Parker Solar Probe flew through the sun's atmosphere, sampling particles and magnetic fields. As Parker flies through the corona, that's the sun's atmosphere, it makes new discoveries that were impossible to study from afar. Scientists say those discoveries about our closest star may help us better understand more distant stars and the rest of the universe. Elsewhere, Japanese billionaire fashion tycoon Yusaka Maezawa and his personal videographer Yozo Hirano started a 12-day journey aboard the International Space Station. They blasted off from the Baikonur Launch Facility in Kazakhstan along with cosmonaut Alexander Masurkin. The trio joined the crew of the ISS, where Maezawa and Hirano became the first self-paying tourists there since 2009. The cost of the trip is unknown. Meanwhile, NASA launched its Imaging X-ray Polarimetry Explorer, or IXPE for short. IXPE's mission is to look at extreme space events to broaden human understanding of objects like neutron stars or spinning black holes. The space observatory carries three identical telescopes, each with dozens of mirrors, to collect and focus X-rays. IXPE's two-year mission is to observe more than 50 objects like supernovas, as well as a supermassive black hole at the heart of our very own Milky Way galaxy. In other news, from a launch pad in Texas, private spaceflight company Blue Origin completed another successful launch and landing, carrying more high-profile passengers. On board were American football star and broadcaster Michael Strahan and a special 74-year-old Laura Shepherd Churchley. 60 years ago, her father, Alan Shepherd, became the first American in space. Shepherd Churchley's roughly 10-minute flight happened aboard the new Shepherd rocket that bears her father's name. Blue Origin says the flight made history as having carried the first-ever parent-child duo, venture capitalist Lane Bess and his 23-year-old son, Cameron. Finally this week, NASA is preparing to launch the James Webb Space Telescope. NASA expects the telescope to allow humans to see further in the cosmos than ever before, ushering in a new era in astronomy. The project faced countless setbacks and a near doubling in cost, with a total price tag north of $9.5 billion, but it's expected to be about 100 times more sensitive than its predecessor, the Hubble telescope. Scientists plan to use it to learn about the universe's history, dating back 13.8 billion years to just after the Big Bang. Blastoff is scheduled for Christmas Eve, December 24th. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
North Korea is commemorating the 10th anniversary of former leader Kim Jong-un's death, which calls for a greater loyalty towards his son and current leader Kim Jong-un. North Korean state newspaper published articles Friday venerating the late leader. Citizens offered flowers and paid homage before a giant bronze statue of Kim Jong-un II and Kim Il-sung at Pyongyang's Mansu Hill. On every previous death anniversary, Kim Jong-un paid respects at a mausoleum where the embalmed body of Kim Jong II lies in state, along with that of his father, Kim Il-sung, the founding leader of the North Korean government. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Powell Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great weekend.